Thanks a lot. As you see, it's not going to be a real debate for several reasons. The first one is that I tend to disagree with a lot of people. I disagree less with Charles Murray than I do with his detractors, typically. So, nevertheless, I disagree with some of the analysis. But before that, let me introduce my concept, my idea of the class of randomness that I call the black swan. What is a black swan? Before the discovery of Australia, the world, the ancient world, the old world had not seen swans of any other color but white. Sure enough, there was that exception, that black bird, quite ugly, I'm told, that was discovered in Australia when, in the 1700s. And sure enough, there could be that exception that could kill a general rule. It was not very consequential. It was just a bird. It probably didn't put anybody out of business, didn't make anybody wealthy. So my black swan is not a bird. It is an event. And it's an event that has three characteristics. Number one, it is highly unexpected, highly improbable, very low probability. Second characteristic is when it happens, it has very large consequences. Think of Google, the computer, Harry Potter. These are black swans. And third, which is going to be the object of this discussion, as you said, we don't have prospective predictability. After the fact, we think that they were predictable, and we explain them away with some analysis, because we're very good at looking in a rear view mirror under the conviction that we're looking straight ahead. And that is the problem with human nature. It is largely a problem with science. Now it's less of a problem with hard science, a lot more of a problem with social science. Let me take one example of a black swan. That was the devastating First World War, which came, I guess, in two volumes, volume one, and then they wanted more of volume two. It was highly unexpected when it happened. But every school child, including myself, we were fed with stories of why it happened because of tensions between Great Britain on one hand, Germany and Austria on the other. But of course, did these tensions cause? No. They were necessary. They were not sufficient. Had they to establish that they caused the war, you have to look at every single crisis that did not end up in Baden-Baden with a bunch of kings getting drunk and listening to opera singers. Because we had a lot of tensions in Europe that did not lead to wars. So we can't look at a war and look at antecedents. You have to count how many of these antecedents led to the event. And effectively, that war was a black swan. For 100 years, we haven't had wars. Nobody was expecting it. My specialty is sort of what I call the narrative fallacy. As an applied statistician and as a researcher and also as a business person, I look at the problem of how we get in trouble with narratives, constructing narratives when we don't have a reason to have them. We cannot live without cause. We cannot live without narratives. Now, I'm not saying that every explanation fell into that trap of what I call the narrative fallacy. I'm saying, in general, we should be cautious of narratives. We effectively have an organ for causality. If you, and not just us, if you put pigeons, that was Skinner experiment. The infamous Skinner had a very interesting experiment that people don't talk about to talk about his bad things. He put pigeons in what was called a Skinner box, fed the bird randomly, and guess what? The bird thought, would develop like a rain dance, thinking it's standing on one leg. When it was fed last time, if it does it again, it would be fed again. So we have this tendency to immediately establish cause, even when we have no reason to establish a cause. On the day when Saddam Hussein was captured, I had at 1301 this on my Bloomberg machine. I was a trader at the time. I'm off and on a trader. 1301, U.S. Treasuries rise on Hussein capture. They couldn't say that the treasuries rose. They had to find a reason. And what was the reason? What happened that day? Well, Hussein was captured. Well, very good. That's the cause. So that's what we were fed at 1301. Interestingly, they say I fish for these reversals, all right? At 1331, U.S. treasuries fall, and they give the same reason. They say, what happened? The bond market's down. What happened? Oh, well, Saddam was captured. Therefore, there's got to be the cause. So we have to watch about causation. We have to watch a lot about causation. Let me refine the problem a little bit. You know, incidentally, I'm using PowerPoint because I'm not very interesting to look at. So to the, you know, distract you from, so that way you can look at Cicero, much better looking human being. I mean, although this doesn't do them justice. Cicero figured out the problem 2,100 years ago, approximately. He figured out the story of the silent evidence, a problem that I'll define as follows, that there are always, you know, when we look at an event, we tend to look at causes that are visible to us, but we don't look at a cemetery of the because of the things that are not obvious and salient to us, because these are not maintained. History tends to kill a lot of information that was not deemed relevant at the time, and effectively he captured it. This is called survivorship bias in finance. We know it very well. In other words, if you're looking at what can cause people to become millionaires, if you look at all the millionaires, you'd find that risk taking is almost a necessity. All rich people took a lot of risks. Now, does it mean that taking risks makes you rich? No, none, unless you establish that those who went bankrupt and who don't write their memoirs, okay, that unless these people did not take a lot of risk, okay? And effectively, if you look in the cemetery of the people who went bankrupt, force them to write their biographies, you discover that they share the same traits. So therefore, taking risk is a necessity to becoming rich. It's also a necessity to go on bankrupt. And you only see the winners, you don't see the losers. Okay? That silent evidence can be generalized to the story of history being written by the history is being written by the winners, not by the losers. And let's see how. In my book, The Black Swan, became a bestseller, and at New York, there's some book fair. A business publisher made the following statement. He said, I know why The Black Swan became a bestseller. It's because it has an animal on a cover and because it has a bird. So I immediately did some research, counted how many books that failed had an animal and a bird. Of course, it's not salient. Because they failed, you don't notice them. Okay, and effectively, you have... I found on Amazon 68 books with the black swan in their title, right? I'm not talking about pink elephant, all the permutation, white, and then try every animal. I didn't try that. Just the very same black swan. So if anything, we counted the ranks on Amazon and discovered, if anything, having an animal and a bird lowers the odds of success. Okay. So I'm warning. And again, I'm not saying that making the inference that an animal and a bird are good things. What I'm saying is that we have this tendency to establish a cause too quickly. There's another problem when we look at the attribution. And here, this discussion is going to address something more general and outside my black swan, and in finding attribution. The gentleman here is Stigler. It's called Stephen Stigler, and he has a law that he concocted. He called it by his name, Stigler's Law of Eponymy. And it tells you the following. Anytime you see the name of a scientist on a law, it's not his. Including the Law of Eponymy, it was discovered by someone else, by Robert K. Merton, the father. Okay. So that law of economy applies literally to anything, all right? We're going to talk about the bell curve. It's called after Gauss. He discovered that it was not Gauss. It has to be Laplace, except that he discovered in places that it was called the Laplace law. So it can't be Laplace. It turned out to be de Moivre. So likewise, why? And that was brilliantly explained in Charles Murray's book. It was Cardano experiment. Until recently, scientists did not name a result based on the discoverer. They named it based on the person who informed them about that law or something like that. The result did not have an owner. So people name things. So this effectively creates... Tell me how many, 2 minutes before. This effectively creates a very severe cemetery of contributions that bear some other people's names. And here... Now I start discussing human accomplishments. Human accomplishments takes that segment of Europe, starting in Edinburgh in the north, I guess, down to Florence, and encompassing most of France and Germany and so on. Not all of Northern Europe. It stops, you know, somewhere in Germany. So you have that segment, and I looked at it, and effectively, I grew up as a very strange bird, but not that strange at the time, I'm from Lebanon, but I'm Greek Orthodox from Lebanon, and we've been living there forever. So for us, the notion of West and East are so artificial, it's not even funny, okay? But people don't understand each other because they use different alphabets. But effectively, they don't even use the different alphabet. If you look alpha, beta, delta, gamma in Greek, they're Semitic words. And actually, of these four, two are still used in spoken language in the Levant. Beta comes from house, bet, in Hebrew and Arabic. And gamma comes from gimel, camel, all right, in Hebrew and Arabic. Okay, so effectively, the notion west-east is rather artificial. And the distinction, but people, there is a narcissism of small differences that makes people tend to amplify the differences rather than similarities. At the time of the Mediterranean, the big contrast was not between East and West. It was between the olive and the Gaula Cisalpina, Gaula Transalpina, between the olive oil and the butter. Basically, the Mediterraneans, actually, even today, if you do a Cavalli-Sforza type analysis of genetic links, you see the Mediterraneans are more in common with each other than further north. And effectively, the definition of Europe started changing. And you don't know, Greece, we're discovering more and more, because solid evidence that a lot more, you know, took a lot more from ancient Egypt than we think. We still don't know enough about ancient Egypt, but it's the place where most documents have been preserved. And so, that notion east-west is a lot more arbitrary. I'm not saying that all notions need to be arbitrary. In the Black Swan, I explained that some things are what I call platonified notions. The difference between male and female. There's much more complicated difference between what is east, what is west, what is north, what is south, because you don't have a clean cut difference. Not even culturally. These get magnified through tension, local tension here and there. The final point I would like to is this, if you look at this graph, it looks exactly like the growth of human knowledge or human accomplishments over the centuries was, of course, between 1500 and 2000. You have a big jump. But why? Because the process is very multiplicative. I did the same with stocks. If you use UK and US and world stocks, from the beginning of the century, you get the same graph. Why? Because we're not looking at it by discounting the effect using something called log-log plot. It's a little technical. But it seems to me, when I looked at human accomplishment, that the rate of growth isn't that much bigger recently. Has not been huge. No more than the stock market growth since 1982 has been massive in consequences, okay, when we plot it against the rest of financial appreciation. So with this, okay, one little graph I wanted to show here to show the difference between east-west. This is by Karachi, and this is Europa. That's what is called Europe. And she was here is when she's taken by the bull, by Zeus, disguised as a bull, taken away from Tyre, where she originates from. That's in Greek mythology. So effectively, Europe that came from Tyre, that the link between Phoenicians and Greek was much more tenuous than we think, with a lot of tensions in between. So thank you very much. I pretty much presented my idea of the black swan and how it sort of weakens a lot of analysis, not all, and not all the way. Thank you. I have a comment on the stability of reputation through time that's quite disturbing, effectively, because I say if Charles wrote his book 25 years ago, he would probably have had different names in literature. But more importantly, had he written it last century, it would have been different scenery. And so I did two things in The Black Swan. Number one is I looked at Nobel Prize winners in literature who at their time were considered the great thinkers and discovered that, sadly, we don't have an idea who is going to be a great thinker. Okay, so reputation has some randomness even after. In other words, in music, it's probably more stable. We don't have that many musicians. In literature, if you take Pearl Buck, nobody knows who she is now. She was a Nobel Prize winner and big American writer. You take the French, Romain Rolland disappeared. Okay, Anatole France disappeared. The first Nobel Prize in literature, Sully Prudhomme. Nobody knows who he is in France. Okay, so you have this instability of people who were considered great in their day later. But there's something even more disturbing. It's the constitution of an ideal library in the French language is severely dependent on the time when it is explained, all right? It's called the paradox of the bouquiniste. Bouquinistes are the people who sell books, old books. So if you look at libraries, okay, the way they were in before the Enlightenment, okay, and you know the big heroes of that time, okay, are completely different from those we study today as being the heroes of before the Enlightenment. The names change even after the person is dead, and even 200 years later, okay, people study different authors. Like an author like Pierre Bayle, the most influential French language philosopher, nobody knows him in France today. But he was influential 100 years after his death. So you have that effectively. The reputations for artists are very unstable. Now, for scientists, it's even worse. We took a field like dermatology. It was discovered that there's some disease, okay, that comes up that has 19 names. You know why? People rediscover it 19 times. There's an epidemic, skin disease. People discover, they give it the name of the doctor who treated it, and then the thing disappears, and people forget it. So we keep having rediscoveries. So effectively, it's very hard to do research on what was a contribution of a given period because of this instability. I have two comments to make. After reading his piece, all right, I went in and checked the state of the Protestants in France. Similar story. Protestants in France have a disproportionate number of Nobel Prizes. They represent less than 1% of the population.
I'm sorry, what group?
Protestants in France, less than 1% of the population, represent the bulk of the wealth, a large disproportionate share of Nobel Prizes winners in every field. And a high number of civil servants in high places, okay? And you do the same, even more disproportionate, is the number of Arabic-speaking Christians.
Like yourself.
Society, okay. And the proportion, the disproportional role, same. So perhaps it's something that affects minorities. They're forced to succeed. Or they're selected in some way or another.
But then you're arguing against yourself if you're arguing it's a black swan random kind of event. Then it's more a cultural issue there, isn't it?
The distinguishing between the random and the deterministic isn't that easy for several reasons. It's not like it's exactly like nature and nurture. You see, you need both. You need both. You need motivation. You will never, never, never become very successful.
Absolutely.
Okay, if you don't buy a lottery ticket, you will not win. So these people work hard. It is highly necessary, but not that sufficient. I have some very skeptical things that I write on the black swan that I'm attacked on. Is what I call the difference between the so-called techne and episteme, the difference between know what and know how. And I put much less faith in know what. I'm a libertarian, so I don't like directed know what, top-down, governmental, direct, university, okay, driven research. It has the universities, all this top-down, all this scientific establishment is very good at PR and getting credit. Effectively, most scientific discoveries were made by accident or made in an undirected, in a garage, just like Google is born in a garage. Most scientific results are born in garages, okay? But a disproportionate share of them is claimed by universities later on. And effectively, now we have a lot of empirical data on that in medicine.